Tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. There's a discourse of the Buddha's where he's teaching his son, and his son has become a novice. The tradition, commentarial tradition, says that this is still when his son is very young, and it's quite a lovely little vignette of the, say, the Buddha giving instruction to his young son, who is now ordained as a novice. And because it's given to the son is still probably only 7, 8, 9 years old, it's externally a very very simple discourse, and it has some very lovely images in it. Begins about aspects of speech, but it goes on to outline a fundamental principle that is characteristic of the whole of the Buddhist teachings, and that is that it's possible to train. In the discourses, that to before one speaks or engages in action or even mental activity, to consider before, during, and after. And it seems, again, pretty simple, pretty basic. But the underlying theme, of course, is that we can actually train. That say, we're not doomed to endless confusion and suffering, because that's how we are right now. There's the possibility of training, and that with training we can change, and we can cultivate and develop that which is skillful, that which is peaceful, that which is wise. And that's so it's an underlying principle that carries through the whole of the teachings. And I think it's important to remember, to reflect on. Just in the same way that, say, like the when a person ordains as a monastic, then one of the instructions that is given is at the end, and encouraging one in the cultivation or the training for higher virtue, higher mind training, and higher wisdom, and that it's all of that is accomplished through training, and or even in a on the basis of the precepts, kind of fundamental moral precepts, are not set out as commandments or as something that is forced on one. One is, I mean, the actual precepts are something that people ask to train in, and then basically the duty of a monastic is in to sort of just outline it, what the training is, but it's all around, I say, a training in conduct, so that and that's embedded in the language. The word is sikha in Pali, and it means training or studying, so learning. So as through our actions we can learn, and that is the sort of fundamental basis of the Buddhist teaching, that we can take our present condition, and we can learn, we can study, and we can cultivate those things which will lead to peace, to freedom, to that which is skillful. So that taking fundamental tendencies and beginning to work with them, and that's the basis of Buddhist philosophy, Buddhist practice. So we recognize that we're motivated to be seeking that which is conducive to happiness, to well-being, and seeking that which is, free from suffering. It's a fundamental motivation, desire. You don't even have to be human to have that desire. I mean, it's just animals. It's a fundamental principle. But usually it's either, say, it's not thought through, it's not considered, it's not developed to any high degree. But then we realize that we can take that and really learn, really train ourselves so that, say, like the developing of loving kindness it's something that is something that is structured or is cultivated. It's not an ideal that is forced on one, in the sense that you should be loving and kind, or you better be loving and kind. It's sort of, this is a possibility that we can cultivate, we can develop. And, you know, one of the reasons is because it's painful to not be that way. It just is very, very simple. As we get stuck in the kind of the reactions of aversion, ill will, irritation, kind of grudge holding, spitefulness. These are things that they're painful to have to deal with, to be with, whether it's having to be with oneself or having to be with others. But particularly, we can't really do very much about other people, but we can do something about ourselves. So that the Buddha outlines ways of cultivation to encourage ourselves in developing of loving kindness. And it's mainly, again, it's sort of, if one looks at the fundamental roots of why we keep suffering, then the Buddha points to three sort of basic defilements: greed, hatred, delusion. And again, they can all be worked on. One can cultivate those qualities which undermine those tendencies, and we can free ourselves from those tendencies. So that, say, the fundamental tendency of ill will, aversion, hatred, is something that we can direct attention towards, say, the cultivation of loving kindness. We can train. And even if it's in small increments, it's something that can be done. And so taking up as something conscious, taking the tendency to aversion, reactivity with irritation, and then actually consciously developing the thoughts of loving kindness. And you know, there's many different ways of doing it. There's very structured ways of doing it. But it hinges on just the ability and the willingness to train. And normally one would pay attention to those say, directing thoughts of kindness towards oneself, because again, that's a fundamental tendency, is that we do want to be happy. We want to be experiencing a sense of well-being. So that by bringing up thoughts of loving kindness, bringing thoughts of that sense of that wishing for physical well-being, security, mental, emotional happiness and well-being, reminding ourselves of that. That's what we want. That's what everybody wants. And directing it towards ourselves, directing it towards those we respect, we love, those who we're friendly with, those who we're neutral towards, even towards those who are either we're hostile towards them or they're hostile towards us. But that willingness to bring attention to that common desire and wish for happiness and well-being, and bringing up those thoughts of kindness. And it's something that when we first do that, it's easy to think, well, this is impossible. Or, what a stupid idea. Why would I want to think nice thoughts about that schmuck? And then, you know, go into the whole stories of why it would be a stupid idea. But then, if you're taking it from a point perspective of training, you realize, well, that's exactly the kind of loop that I don't want to get caught in. It's exactly the thing that just keeps weighing the mind down. So that, but again, it's sort of making it conscious and making the process conscious, and then the bringing into being of those thoughts of loving kindness. And at first it's something that seems like lighting a match in a howling windstorm or something, and it just is poof, it's gone. But you also realize that by protecting, in the same way that if one were trying to light a fire, wind is blowing, you can do things to protect it. You can bring barriers to the wind. You can sort of, and you can protect that small flame so that it starts to catch. So in the same way with just these protecting those thoughts of kindness and of goodwill, it's something that we can do, and it starts to gain momentum. So that we can train. We can train the mind to do that. The mind can be directed towards those thoughts of goodwill, of caring, of kindness. And the more momentum there is, then the more confidence arises that, yes, this definitely feels better, and it's on a feeling tone that we gain a sense of confidence and stability. So that bringing it back to the feeling tone of what the result is, because on a rational basis, you know, it doesn't make sense. Or the mind can, you know, find endless reasons to not bother, to not do it. But it's, you realize, you know, the whole function of say practice is not, it's not about say the logic of it or the rationalizations of it. It's around the underlying feeling. And that's why it's so important to be attending to that sense of what is conducive to happiness and well-being, what is conducive to suffering. That's what, say, Ajahn Chah would always emphasize and say language and our rational mind can explain all sorts of things, but you know it tends to tie us up, and we need to be able to just experience things directly. In the same way of just a, you know, like a glass of water, you know, you can describe it in all sorts of ways, but what you need, there's a big difference of just using, taking a drink of the water and saying, you know what it feels like, you know the experience of drinking the water is and how refreshing that is. So in the same way with practice, if we think about it, trying to analyze it over and over, it tends to, we get tangled up in ourselves. But the actual direct experience of something like loving kindness, learning how to hone into the feeling tone of that. In the same way working with the tendencies to greed, and it's not just sort of, you know, greedy. It's more like this desire, that craving, wanting, that desire for gratification. Gratification, stimulation, excitement, and pleasure, the pleasure that comes from getting what one wants. And it can be on a sensual level, it can be on, you know, so many different levels. But the avenue of gratification is through the sense bases of sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, and the mind itself. To recognize how that desire process works, Again, this is, takes training, because the impulse is always to reach out. I mean, that's what, say, like aversion, ill will, pushes away, like, I don't want, but the desire sort of reaches out and wants to pull it in, and that, how can I get, how can I consume, how can I possess, how can I have that for me now? And it, that's really tiring. It's so, and the that sense of a lack of contentment that we experience with desire. So that paying attention to one, to how that dynamic works, and again, that takes training to be able to watch. And that's one of the, say, the benefits of meditation, is to be able to recognize the tendencies that we have and how it affects us. As the mind becomes quieter, then we can see those tendencies more clearly. I can remember early years of being a monk and being in a quiet forest monastery, doing a lot of meditation, and one can get obsessed with trying to meditate or doing the training, trying to learn all the rules, learn the chanting, and I remember one time it started to hit me of this feeling in my heart, in my chest, and in my heart base. And I was just, what is that? And then sort of seeing, wow, that's just a kind of unadulterated, undiluted desire, looking for an object. It was really interesting, because that the tendency to believe in the objects of our desire are it's distracting, and one has to pay attention to that, because we do get. It's easy to get obsessed in with the objects of desire, the things that are attractive, interesting, fascinating. But underlying that is just that desire, looking for an object all the time. And when one's seeing that, is it, wow, that is suffering. And it's really, to be able to actually live with contentment. It's not that one doesn't experience anything or shuts everything out, but just to be contented and to be happy with what one is experiencing, with what one has. And you train yourself with the material world around us, and question and investigate. Is that enough? It's like for the monastics, and there's one of the chants that we're and things we're supposed to be reflecting on every day is the. Our requisites of robes, alms food, shelter, medicines. But for everybody, that you extend that definition out, and it is sort of clothing, food, shelter, medicines for oneself. Everybody has to rely on that. Everybody has to depend on it. And to be able to reflect and investigate, what is it that actually makes me happy? You know, is it the accumulation, getting, consuming? Some things we do need. What's the difference between need and desire? Those are. It's essential to be investigating that and saying, well, what is it that leads to contentment? What is it that leads to satisfaction, being satisfied with what one has? Because it's so typical that when we desire focuses on a particular object, as soon as we get it, we're happy. And then, pretty soon it's ordinary, we forget about it. And then the mind moves on to the next thing. So sometimes there's, I just read an article where there's a group of people, starting in San Francisco, where people are not buying new things. Just stepping out of the... So that there's a whole sort of economy developing around sharing and giving and exchanging and bartering. Which is great, just to be able to step back from that kind of. It doesn't mean one does without or is not getting anything whatsoever, but it's sort of just stepping back from that tendency of the gratification, moving, consuming, possessing, because you're attenuating. The tendency to desire. And it's a training. And that's what's important. Because again, it's not an idealistic thing of you have to do without. But it's more like, how do you step back enough to be able to understand the desire process? Because that's where contentment and happiness, peace comes from. It's not necessarily... doing it. So it's like there's a discourse from the time of the Buddha where a particular religious seeker came and was praising the Buddha, and the Buddha asked him, well, what is it that you see that is so special? And what this religious seeker started to praise was more around the ascetic side or the ascetic ideal that was very much a part of Indian culture. And the Buddha said, well, that's actually not an actual or real basis to praise me, because I've got lots of disciples who are way more ascetic than I am. Some of them, hardly eat any food, and I'll eat a full bowl of food sometimes. So others they'll just wear rag robes and cast off cloth that's been collected from the charnel ground. He says, sometimes I'll wear silks and they'll offer silk robes. I'll wear them. Special robes from sort of Benares, the fine Benares cotton. And then others are living at the foot of a tree, and some live in some pretty nice dwellings. So he said, that's not the basis. So there's certain standards of appropriateness, but they say the religious ideal is more an understanding those roots of suffering, greed, hatred, and delusion, and being able to free oneself from that. So it's from that understanding. And then setting up the training, which we learn to, you know, learning contentment. Like being content, being happy with what we're actually experiencing. And watching the tendency to how we project that. Because it's that projection is quite insidious, actually, because and it's quite, it seems so reasonable that, you know, right now is okay, but once I get that, then that'll be really good. That'll be really right. Then I can be content. Then I can be happy. Then I can be peaceful. And we do that on the material realm. We do that in our meditation. We do that when we get the right conditions for our mind to really be peaceful. And it goes on and on. You know, and then you die and you do it all over again. This is never really learning contentment. It's being able to take it as a point of training. It's how can I be content with this? How can I be happy with this? What is the obstacle? Because some things are, you know, one does need to be, you know, one would be foolish to be content with. It's like the story of the Ajahn Chah's disciple who, decided that he was going to learn about letting go and relinquishment and by not bothering to fix his roof that had part of his roof had blown off in the rainy season, in the monsoon season. So he's training himself in letting go. Ajahn Chah found out about it a few days after and blasted him for not fixing his dwelling place. And he said, "Wow, you keep teaching us about letting go, and here I am trying to let go, and I don't know what to do." And he said, "Wow, you're living like a sort of like a monkey or a gibbon in the forest, sort of curling up in the corner, trying to keep away from the rain. I mean, that's not letting go. That's foolishness. I mean, that's the time to do something." And that's the time to get out there and use some initiative to fix it. I suppose that's really the basis for training in terms of delusion. You know, how do we make those decisions and discernment? Where we're not following our desires, following our biases, following our confusion, and again, you can't come from an ideal. You have to rely on training and recognizing, investigating, pay attention, and what is it that leads to well-being? What is it that leads to happiness? What is it that leads to peace? And it's something that we can train ourselves in, so that you're recognizing, I follow that sort of ideal, but then I keep butting up against either conflict with others or frustration internally, maybe that isn't working. So that under investigating the kind of delusion, that's because delusion functions by, I say, confusion or self kind of grasping or self delusion, a sense of lack of clarity. So that the training that we do, particularly that training in mindfulness, clear comprehension, and kind of that discernment, investigation, examination, wise reflection. Those are things that Ajahn Chah gives the image. He says when you go to pick up a heavy log, and you need two people, one on either end, and then it's kind of heavy, so then another person comes in and helps out. He says, like, it's mindfulness, clear comprehension on either end, and then wisdom comes, and discernment comes and helps pick up so that you can carry that weight, carry that log. And in terms of our own internal practice and training, it's that training in mindfulness, clear comprehension, that's there's that sense of paying attention, because mindfulness isn't just focusing in, honing in on the moment. It's also that's what mindfulness does. Clear comprehension is what's paying attention to the context, the situation, the results. And how does it affect me? How does it affect others? So clear comprehension is that's its function. And then discernment in wisdom is that discernment of what is it that leads to that which is skillful, what's actually unskillful, what is leading to happiness and well-being, what leads to suffering. That's the function of wisdom. Wisdom isn't just a particular view or a set formula or a set piece of knowledge. That's actually why the word wisdom is sometimes not a good translation for what comes from the scriptural word, because discernment's actually a much better word, because it's wisdom. The word from Pali is panya, and it comes from the verb pajanati, which is to know or to understand. And so it's a noun that comes from an action. So to discern, so discernment is probably a better word. So that the result of knowing, the result of understanding. So there's an engagement, because sometimes wisdom has that sort of passive sort of quality, or something that is somehow, some piece of wisdom that's somehow passed on, a lump of wisdom that you can finally get. But no, it's something that you engage in, you're involved in. So being involved in the process of knowing and understanding. And that's training. It's again, it highlights that such a fundamental quality of the Buddhist teaching, that the training plays a huge role in how we pick up the Buddha's teachings. So that to pick up the Buddha's teachings in a way that we're willing to train, to study, and to investigate. You know, what is it? What's the result of greed, hatred, and delusion? What's the result of contentment, of loving kindness, of discernment, in training, studying, investigating, making choices for ourselves. You know, the Buddha is confident that the choice would be one of a peace, of non-suffering, of a sense of having a stability, an inner stability, an inner refuge, so that he's giving us the tools. Now it's up to us. I'll offer that for reflection.
Anjamayam dhammakataya sadhu karam dhamase.